Welcome to the American Cafe. I'm your host, David Byrd. We want to look at a controversial and sensitive topic this week, surviving sexual abuse. From the Harvey Weinstein cases in Hollywood to Larry Nassar and USA Gymnastics to a recent grand jury report on abuse by Catholic priests, it seems that sexual abuse has been in the headlines. This week, we talk to a marriage and family therapist about sexual abuse, why it happens, and what survivors and their families can do.
It has never occurred to us as a culture to begin teaching other human beings how to manage sexuality intelligently.
Surviving sexual abuse on this week's American Cafe. Last week, Pennsylvania Attorney General Josh Shapiro released a grand jury report that identified more than 1,000 children abused by more than 300 Catholic priests over several decades.
Priests were raping little boys and girls, and the men of God who were responsible for them not only did nothing, they hid it all for decades.
This report reverberated around the world, with Pope Francis issuing a letter saying the church must acknowledge and condemn with sorrow and shame abuse by priests and others. But the church case is only the latest in a series of sexual abuse scandals in the news. For some perspective on sexual abuse, both what can lead to someone becoming a perpetrator and how survivors can find hope, I spoke with Stephen Ng, a marriage and family therapist who specializes in sex therapy. I started by asking him if there are root causes for sexual abuse.
There's really no causes for me to make a certain choice. However, there are a lot of contributing factors that can degrade my ability to make quality decisions. So for a quick example would be, I'm a kid born into an abusive family. I've got attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. My mom is an alcoholic. Well, wow, there's three strikes right there. It's going to make it really difficult for me to be successful in school and feel good about myself. And so I'm going to increasingly become discouraged, seek out those children who are smoking on the corner of the playground, and eventually with them start drinking and using other drugs. And so you see this cascade of events that in the life of the next little baby boy who's born, and he's as cute and adorable and as intelligent as any other baby boy, if we start loading him up with risk factors, his ability to make quality decisions as he approaches his sexually active years later in life, that ability is going to be harshly degraded.
Are people born with a predilection towards sexual abuse, or is it something that might never manifest in somebody's life if they are never in that environment?
It's really very clear that we all want the same things when we're born. We all want to have a happy life. We all want to get along. None of us want to go to prison when we get older. And no little boy I've ever interviewed says he wants to grow up to become a sex offender. And yet somehow we lose our way along the path. And I think the number one cause has nothing to do with genetics. The number one cause is a failure to develop normally. And by that I mean, we all remember being back in elementary school and the little boys, in particular the little boys, but sometimes little girls too, who were incapable of making friends. They lacked the sort of social skills that would enable them to get the kind of support so many of us take for granted in life. And as those children develop, they become increasingly isolated as they get older. And as they get older, they fail to learn the next set of skills, which is intimacy skills that would enable them to get their needs for love met appropriately and legally. So what we see is, you know, when you're in kindergarten, it's not unusual for one kindergartner to be in love with another, to have a big crush on either a fellow student or even perhaps their teacher. Our sexuality doesn't spring forth suddenly when we hit puberty or later when we hit 18. It's part of who we are all through our lifespan. And if we're not paying attention to the developmental steps that are important, in fact, critical, in the normal development of any child, then what we're doing is we're actually contributing to the likelihood that that boy will grow up to become a sex offender because he's still going to have the needs that that he was born with, that we're all born with, the needs for love, the needs to affiliate, the needs to feel significant in the life of someone else. And if you can't get those needs met legitimately and honorably, we're setting the child up for getting them met illegitimately and dishonorably. You know, the old rabbis 1,000 years ago said, the man who fails to teach his son a trade teaches him to steal. We have a policy in our country of, if we do allow for sexual education, David, it's typically of kind of an anatomy and physiology model where we teach parts, body parts that is, we teach function of the organs, we teach about how people get pregnant, that sort of thing. What we don't teach is human sexuality in the context of human relationships. And it would be so easy for us to predict who's at risk for growing up to commit a sex crime, because it would be those boys, primarily boys is what we're talking about, those boys who don't have any friends. They're all by themselves out on the playground. They never have any friends. It would be those boys who never develop crushes and find a meaningful and legitimate way for them to express their attraction to others and who have some success. So my brain is full of thousands of stories from my clients over the last 2 decades who have failed these developmental tasks. They've gone on to have enormous career success, and we've seen that in every industry, from the military to media to even my field, counseling. We see it right now. I think immigration is having some accusations of sexual impropriety, government with our senators. The list doesn't stop. Human beings can be brilliant in a given field, like a career, for example, or naturally gifted at something like physics. But we don't naturally get gifted in how to interact with other human beings. We have to be taught how to do that. And we don't teach any of our children how to do any of those tasks.
Let's shift gears here for just a second to those who have survived sexual abuse. How can someone who has survived sexual abuse begin to heal?
You know, David, there's really no way around this, but victims have got to find a way, and I hope with a lot of our help, to start facing the reality of their history, that they were abused, that they were mistreated, and then to start working through some of the many irrational beliefs like it was my fault, or I brought this on myself, or somehow I deserved it, or somehow this defines me. If we're going to help children and then the later adult work through these issues, they've got to face it head on. However, having said that, none of us grow in exactly the same way, which is why therapy is something of an art as well as a science, because different people benefit from different approaches, and we can't make all people do the same thing at the same time and in the same way and have the same results or the same outcomes. For example, boys typically need more time to get ready to talk than girls do. Girls are just naturally speedier at processing and being able to process what kinds of disasters have occurred in their history. Boys have a harder time. Perhaps it's because of some of our beliefs about masculinity and what it means to be a man. But for whatever reason, every child is different. Every child is going to have, every one of the children we're talking about is going to have a history of early childhood trauma. And out of that trauma, they're going to have terribly bad feelings. And each and every single one of those children is going to develop compulsive, self-soothing behaviors. And that's usually what we focus on. We criticize him for drug abuse or her for becoming very controlling or both of them for being such workaholics. And we're not paying attention to, well, why is it that they are so compulsive? And until we are societally ready to have that conversation and to start conversing about sexuality, it's going to be really hard for us to help them. There's a little bit of the physician heal thyself here, because we all need to get a lot more comfortable talking about this.
I know that it seemed to be very healing in the case of the gymnastics doctor for the survivors to be able to go to court and tell their story, tell their version of things, to say, you did this to me, and this is what how it made me feel. Is that crucial in healing, and are there other things that people might need to do?
Well, you are spot on, David, in saying that. And the only little bit of controversy is how old does a person need to be to start talking about that sort of thing publicly? Typically, we want to guard against young children going to court and facing their accusers. And so we allow perpetrators to plead guilty to a lesser charge. I think this is an enormous mistake. I think children are empowered, just as adults are, by finally getting to tell their story and realizing, oh, society is on my side. I didn't do anything wrong. I was the one who was hurt. I wasn't the perpetrator of this. So, you know, I think that's the only little bit that's controversial, and it's a decision every parent has to make. But I think you're exactly right. I think it's all about coming out. And that's where the healing begins, not only for the victim, but for us societally, where we could become more comfortable with managing human sexuality intelligently, rather than just trying to repress it and not talk about it.
That's Stephen Ng. If you would like to learn more about Stephen or his work, we will have a link to his website on our Facebook page, VOA American Cafe. That's also where you can post your questions or comments. You can find other editions of our programs at voanews.com. Until next time, I'm David Byrd. Thanks for listening.